unlawfully fair escorted ICE to a university apartment and arrested a student from Korea. That's not acceptable. This is an era of renewed hope. Students in our generation need to take action again, put forward what we think should happen in society, and Berkeley should be in the lead of that and be the first sanctuary campus of the nation. Please sign this petition and we'll collect it after class. Thank you.
Now, I hope you had a good time last night. Did you figure it all out? Did you figure it all out? Shush, shush, shush. Shh. Did you work it all out? No? Right. By the way, number one. Question number one. We would love it if you would, we would really insist that it be a dialogue, right? You know, you write it out as a real debate. Take it seriously. Script. You've seen enough debates. Now you're going to have a real debate organized by yourselves between two great intellects. Right. Smith and Marx. Yes. Okay. Right. Any questions about the midterm? Okay. Very good. Very good. All right. What else do I have to say? Ah, yes. I know that some of you are going to get bored having no reading over the weekend. Right, Christy? So, I've given you some pages to read, 556 to 573. That's Engels. He's making reflections on what's happening at the turn of the century, about writing 1895 and social democracy. It will provide the foundations of what I have to say on Tuesday. And I hope to see you all here on Tuesday. I know you'll be exhausted, but you will be entertained, as ever. Yes. Right. Okay. But anyway, this is not compulsory. That is only for those who are feeling a bit bored on the beach. Right. So what we're going to do today is the finale, the finish. And we're going to finish with Marx's own summary. His own summary, his own account of what he thought his theory was about. And it's a beautifully succinct summary, pages 4-5 in the reader. It's from the preface to the contribution to the critique of political economy. Ha ha, yes. Right, but before then we're going to summarize. Okie dokie. Okay. Competitive capitalism gives rise to competition amongst capitalists, which leads to simplification, new technology, family labor, the expulsion of laborers into the reserve army of unemployed, lowering of wages, and the polarization between classes, leading to crises of overproduction on the one side and the deepening of class struggle on the other side. And then, as a result of the deepening of crises of overproduction and the intensification of class struggle that coincide with one another, and Bob's your uncle, communism. That's Marx and Engels. We spent quite a lot of time arguing, talking about what's problematic about that. And we came up with an alternative picture, which says competitive capitalism leads to crises of overproduction, leads to class struggle, leads to a new form of capitalism. We're going to call it organized capitalism. Organized capitalism. And that organized capitalism is organized by what? Is organized by the state. The state, do you know what the state is by any chance? Who knows what the state is? The state is, you must have learned this in high school, the state has three branches, remember. The executive, the judiciary, and the legislature. That is the state. But But for Marx and Engels, the question is, what does the state do? Well, we'll see in a minute what they thought it did, but we now know that the state gets very much involved in counteracting these crises of overproduction. We see it today. And we see the state also not only organizing the relations among capitalists, but also organizing the relations between capital and labor, organizing class struggle. Bless you. Very good. The state. This gives rise. See, what Marx and Engels thought, that the end of competitive capitalism would be the end of all capitalism and end would come communism. They did not anticipate that the very phenomenon that they saw emerging, namely the development of joint stock companies, of trusts, of state ownership of the means of production, they did not see this as a new form of capitalism, but the last legs of competitive capitalism, which would, in fact, the last legs of all capitalism that would then give rise to communism. They saw the emerging concentration of capital as laying the foundations for a new planned society called communism. And they assumed that the class struggle would intensify and the working class would seize power. But they were largely wrong, not completely wrong. They were amazingly right in the sense that they understood that competitive capitalism couldn't last, but they didn't understand that organized capitalism would come in its place. So, given that, there are three criticisms we made last time. Three fundamental criticisms of the theory of Marx and Engels. The first is the theory of transition. And that is, they have no theory of transition. Bob's your uncle theory of transition is a no theory of transition. This is not immaculate conception. They have really no understanding of how actually communism will be, even be organized if the working class seize power. So, no theory of transition. Second, their theory of class struggle. Class in itself, remember, this is in the Communist Manifesto, to class for itself. These are the objective conditions, class in itself, degradation, despotism, homogenization, and polarization. Those objective conditions that the working class face is supposed to lead to a class for itself, class in itself to a class for itself, in which a class fights, organizes itself collectively and fights for its interests, first in scattered struggles, then through trade unions, then through a political party. And the assumption is that class struggle leads to more class struggle leads to more class struggle. And sometimes it does. But in fact, looking back historically, we see that actually class struggle led to what? Concessions. And what that meant is that when workers were able to fight, and when they got the factory acts and reduced the length of working day, when they fight for increased wages, when they fight for welfare, when they fight for unemployment compensation, they realize what? That they can make gains within the framework of capitalism and therefore do not need to do what? Go beyond capitalism. Their revolutionary fervor, in a sense, domesticated, contained, and their class struggle is organized within the framework of capitalism. They are not, therefore, a revolutionary class. So, the second point. The first point, there's no theory of transition. The second point is that their theory of class struggle is wrong. But in one way, why is it wrong? It's wrong because, of course, it's wrong because the working class is able to assure itself gains. And who enforces those gains on behalf of the working class? None other than what we call the state. Whether it through factory acts, whether it through minimum wage legislation, whether it through welfare, whether it be through recognition of trade unions, the state is at the core of the enforcement of those interests of the working class against capitalists. Now, Marx and Engels do have sentences here and there, all over the place, about the state. And they are brilliant sentences. But they didn't see how brilliant they were. They didn't see Let me give you page 475. 475 is the most magnificent sentence about the state. 475. Bridget, read it out for us. Very good question. Does anybody know? Anybody seen the great passage on the state on 475? Anybody help Bridget? Where it is? I've forgotten my book. I got you awake, didn't it? Aha! Okay, there's Jane.
The third paragraph about political advancement of the bourgeoisie class.
Yeah, it's in the third paragraph. Yeah, brilliant, Christy. Where?
It's
two lines up from the bottom
of the third paragraph.
You there, Bridget?
Yes.
Okay, the executive of the modern state. I don't need a book. I know this book off by heart. Ha 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 ha! You will when you've been teaching this for 30 years. Yes, yes, Bridget.
The executive of the modern state,
the center, the core of the modern state, is nothing. A committee for managing
the common affairs
of the whole bourgeoisie. You know, there are all sorts of sociologists who are so sloppy who say that the state is the committee. Very good, thank you very much. For managing, what was it? What do they say? They say, I can't even remember now, it's so messed up. It's a committee of the bourgeoisie, they say. An executive committee of the bourgeoisie. But no, Marx and Engels are saying it is not an executive committee of the bourgeoisie. It is not an instrument of the bourgeoisie. What is the state? It is an executive committee for managing the common affairs of the whole bourgeoisie. And what are the common affairs of the whole bourgeoisie? Katie.
Care of their workers.
Taking care of their workers, yes. Yes, Jason? Looking after the long-term interests of the entire capitalist class, which are what? Juliana?
Sustain
capitalism. Thank you. Yes. Which involves looking after the workers and after the long-term interests of the capitalist class. It is a matter of the state maintains capitalism as a system. The state doesn't care if a particular capitalist goes broke. It wants to keep the capitalist system going. It's interesting. Lehman Brothers, don't matter. Let them go broke. But AIG, that would bring the whole system down. So make quite sure that does not go broke. The state makes judgments about what is necessary to keep the system going. And it will act against individual capitalists in order to do so. And that is the beautiful passage. But Marx didn't understand what he was saying. He was so brilliant. You know, he just didn't quite grasp the significance of what he was saying, namely that if the state has this capacity to actually ensure capitalism continues against the development of the crisis of production, then a new form of capitalism can emerge, one called organized capitalism. Marx and Engels did not anticipate this. Okay, very good. So here we are. What I would say then about the state is that they have an undeveloped theory of the state. Undeveloped. So there we have the summary. First, no theory of transition. Second, a false theory of class struggle. Their theory of class struggle says that the working class is going to be the gravedigger of capitalism. It turns out that the working class is the savior of capitalism through its struggles, generates concessions via the state, and in that way, counteracts the crises of overproduction. So, theory of class struggle is wrong. And finally, third, the undeveloped theory of the state. They have these sentences and sometimes paragraphs about the state, but they don't really ever develop a theory of the state. Those are the three problematic features, in my view, of the theory of Marx and Engels with respect to capitalism and the transition to communism. Now, okay, suppose this is our story. Organized capitalism. What has happened since the 1970s is some people got it into their heads to go back in history, or to go forward as backwards, to a new form of competitive capitalism. This began in the 1970s, consolidated in the Reagan era in this country. What is this new competitive capitalism? It's a new phase of what they call it? Neoliberalism. And what does it entail? What sort of things? Quickly. Opening financial markets, deregulating banks so that they could actually entertain all these lousy loans, pursuing profit, but bringing down the whole system in the process. What else does it involve? What else does this new competitive capitalism begins in the 1970s involve? Hands up, yes?
Greater polarization.
Greater?
Polarization.
Yeah, that's one of the consequences. But what about the policies? What sort of things? What polarization? What form does that polarization take? Yes?
They like recoil to the welfare state.
Yes, the welfare state is retracted. The level of welfare becomes less, and we get not welfare, we get workfare. So there is a reduction of the benefits, the social benefits people do get when they're out of work. Yes, what else, Jason?
I just have a question. How is this like considerably different from how it was before the Great Depression?
Yes, well, in a sense, one's going back. That is precisely the point. One is going back to an era before organized capitalism that was itself competitive capitalism. Indeed, that is the case. And what was distinctive of that era, for example, was there were very few trade unions. So this was, again, a period in which there was an offensive against trade unions. Today, I don't know, 7% of the private sector is unionized. At the beginning of the 1970s, it was about, I don't know, about 25 to 30%. So, unions have fallen. So, and if you look globally, what has happened? Opening up of markets, free trade, NAFTA. And if you go to other countries, there's things called structural adjustment, which is the International Monetary Fund attempt to impose markets on poor countries, saying they will only get loans if they satisfy certain conditions. Those conditions are the expansion of the market, the diminution of the public sector, privatizations of industries. And in post-Soviet countries, it was all about what? Yes, I heard it.
Shock therapy.
Bring the market in quick. We've got to destroy the old system, privatize overnight. And they did. Disaster followed. So the whole series of policy changes under this new form of competitive capitalism undid this organized capitalism. And now the chickens are coming home to roost. Now the chickens are coming home to roost. This competitive capitalism is showing itself to be unsustainable. And so what is beginning to happen? Sorry?
It's moving back to the organized.
Yes, it's going to slowly but surely be moving back to the organized capitalism. That's my prediction. That there will be increasingly a recession, perhaps a depression, but this will lead to increased state intervention. Increased regulation of the economy. And so what seems impossible and what governments have said will never ever happen again will indeed happen again, precisely because states want to maintain capitalism, and the only way is to go back to organized capitalism or to go where? Very good. Now, it's unlikely what will go forward to communism, precisely because what's missing? There's revolutionary class. We don't have that. So we might go back to forward to communism. We also might go to barbarism. Ha ha. Yes, you're laughing, but it won't be a laughing matter, believe me. Yes, anyway. All right. That's my sort of summary statement of a commentary and reflection on the writings of Marx and Engels' theory of capitalism. They missed the idea of an organized capitalism, and ironically enough, once that was established after the Second World War, you might say, in this country and other countries too, in the 1970s, there was an attempt to go back to the competitive capitalism, and now we are experiencing the consequences of that move. Fine, terrific. It is 4 o'clock. I've got 1 hour to go through Marx's 7 theses. I believe there are 7 theses on pages 4 to 5. Now, before I do that, are there any questions? Yes, Jessica.
Competitive capitalism will either go to communism, barbarism, or organized capitalism?
Yes. I think there are 3 options. Yes. Yes. Yes, that's right. Yes. Yes. Yes, but I think, as I say, I think this is a bit unlikely. And I don't know what that's going to look like now. Fascism, as it was in the 1930s, yeah. Yes.
So, if competitive capitalism needs, like, the state to get to organized capitalism and a revolutionary class for communism, what would it need for barbarism?
Well, I think if competitive capitalism, if in fact these state initiatives don't succeed, or if the ideology continues to get the better of the state in a sense, and the state does not act to organize capitalism, it cannot go back to organized capitalism, because the state fails to constitute itself as the center of this new regulated capitalism, then the whole thing's going to crumble. And if it crumbles, it could go in the direction of communism, if and only if there is a strong working class. If it's not communism, and it's not organized capitalism, then I believe it's something called barbarism. It will be sort of a very chaotic, anarchic, you might say, or repressive fascist regime. That was the nature of fascism in the 1930s, 40s. It was in fact, I mean, I'm not really being fair to fascism, because fascism was actually a form of organized capitalism. The state was actually quite well centered in the organization of the economy. This barbarism, I don't know what it'll look like. This is a big question mark. What it would be. Interesting question. Interesting. Well, not too interesting. Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, the point is, it's neither communism nor organized capitalism. Okay? Going gone. Right. We have 58 minutes. 7 into 58 goes 8. 8 and a bit. Go. Is that what you said? Go. All right. Let me tell you, I'm going to spend 2 minutes, so that will make it exactly 8 minutes each. I'm going to spend 2 minutes telling you about this piece. This piece is, as I was saying, was, I think it was written in 1857. It's a summary of Marx and Engels, or Marx's view of history. It is a wonderfully succinct summary that has been the basis of fundamental ideological, scientific, political struggles. What on earth does Marx mean by every word on these 2 pages? We could spend the entire year diagnosing every word, but we probably have to go back to the German. But anyway, it's a very succinct statement of the theory, and that's why I like to end with it. And it's been subject to a lot of debate, as we'll see. There are a lot of ambiguities in these 2 pages. This theory is that he puts forward is a theory of history, and we call it historical materialism. Historical materialism. That is to say, it's a sort of materialist analysis of history. It's a sort of Marxian analysis of history, a materialist analysis of history that ultimately, in which the economy is the foundational element. Yeah. So it's called historical materialism. And it's a really fascinating 2 pages, which I know you'll know is fascinating because you've read it 10 times. Great, great. And let me say one other thing about this, these 2 pages. What Marx does, and this is the secret, you know, he spends a lot of time, we haven't read a hundredth of what he's written, but he spends a lot of time in his writings talking about capitalism and the theory that we've expounded over the last 2 weeks. And he does, really, his whole emphasis is on the rise and fall of capitalism. And what he does, he takes that theory of capitalism and projects it back into history, projects it back onto previous modes of production without a lot of empirical basis, without a lot of empirical evidence. So we're not going to examine this theory for its empirical validity at this point. We're going to examine it for its intellectual coherence, its internal coherence. But the most important point, I think, he wants to sort of generalize what he has learned about capitalism to the whole of history. And the result is a fascinating two pages. Okay. All right, you ready? All right, we got 55 minutes. The first one is simple. Let's read it. Who should read this? Who should read it? Heather, why don't you read page 4? Page 4. You know, you see in the middle of that page, M. Guizot?
The general result.
That's where we begin. Okay, why don't you read from the general result? Read two sentences.
The general result at which I arrived and which, once won, served as a guiding thread for my studies can be briefly formulated as follows.
Sounds like a sort of a PhD student, but anyway, go on. Yes. Yes, the sort of dissertations they write. Go on. Yes.
In the social production of their life.
In the social production of their life.
Men enter into definite relations.
Men enter into definite relations.
That are indispensable.
That are indispensable.
Independent.
And independent of their will. Beautifully read, Heather. Perfect. You made the sort of the stops in exactly the right place. In the social production of their life, men enter into men and women enter into definite relations that are indispensable and independent of their will. Relations of production, continue.
Which correspond to a definite stage of development of their material productive forces.
Right, they enter into relations of production which correspond to a definite stage of development of the material productive forces. What I want to emphasize here is this idea of social relations that are independent and are indispensable and independent of people's will. What is an example of that? Workers. Yes, Jessica. Yes, you, Jessica.
Like race?
Race, yes, that's right. What is race?
Well, difficult.
Aha. But race, you might say that race relations are something that human beings construct, that race is something constructed, and we do not control what race we are. But Marx and Engels are actually not talking about race. They're talking about
class.
Class. And what's your name?
Ariana.
Ariana. Okay. Ariana. Very good. Okay. I better write that up there. Ariana. With an A or an O?
With an A.
Ariana. Okay. All right. It's the only way I'm going to do this. I reach a plateau. It's like the forces of production. They get fettered and my mind gets fettered with names. Yes, Ariana. Okay, yes. Class. Now, let's take the working class. In what sense do workers enter into relations that are indispensable? Anders. Yes. Why is it indispensable? Why are these relations into which they enter indispensable? They cannot do without them. Jane?
If they don't enter into these relations, they can't survive.
Absolutely. If workers do not enter into relations with capitalists, do not sell their labor power to some capitalist, they cannot survive because? Ariana, because they don't get a?
Wage,
absolutely. So, one sees why they have to enter into those relations. Those relations are indispensable. But in what sense are those relations independent of their will? Indispensable, but independent of their will. Jason.
Because
You don't get to choose the family you're born into.
Yes, yes. But what would Marx say? Marx doesn't say a lot about what family you're born into. That's absolutely true. You don't choose the class you belong to. But those relations that the worker enters into are independent of their will. The capital-labor relations, independent of their will. In what sense is it independent of their will? The capital-labor relations, Lauren.
It's because they're sort of forced by society to enter into these relationships.
And what happens to these relations? What happens to workers that is independent of their will? What happens to workers that is independent of their will?
Exploitation.
Exploitation, absolutely, is independent of their will. What happens as a result of exploitation to those workers? Well, that's one possibility. That's not what I was looking for, though. That's a very good answer. But no. What happens to those workers as a result of entering into those relations and becoming exploited? What happens to them? What happens to them? Immiseration. Very good. And what else happens to them?
Become irreplaceable. Dispensable.
What happens to those workers, Rosa, when a new machine arrives? And they beautifully unpack this new machine. They are displaced, and what happens to the workers?
They lose it.
They lose their job. And they enter into the
reserve
army of unemployed. Very good, Rosa. Yes. So those relations have a logic of their own. Those relations have a logic of their own. That is what we've been talking about for the last 2 weeks. The ways in which capitalism is like a machine and operates like a machine and spews people out here and spews them in there. Independent of their will, the relations of capitalism are independent of the will of workers. They don't know whether they'll lose a job tomorrow. They need the job, indispensable, but those relations in which they have a logic of their own. Now, the interesting question is this. Can we say the same for capitalists? Can we say the same for capitalists? Do capitalists enter into relations that are indispensable? Come on.
Yes.
Lauren?
Yes.
That's a good answer. Well, why?
Because they need the workers to use the work for them. They want to
right.
survive and they want their...
If capitalists are going to survive as capitalists, they must do what?
They must compete.
They must compete. Introduce new machines, right, Greg? All right, so they themselves have to enter into relations that are indispensable. Indispensable. They cannot make money, make profit without entering into these relations of competition, without exploiting workers, without dominating workers, regulating workers. But, and this is the big question, are those relations independent of the will of capitalists? Are those relations independent of the will of capitalists? What do Marx and Engels say, Chelsea? No, they never say that. They're always very excited.
Yes, independent of it.
Why?
Because capitalism relies on... Wait, I forgot your question.
The question is whether these relations into which capitalists enter, capitalist relations of exploitation, capitalist relations of competition, whether those relations are independent of the will. Do they have a will, in a sense, a will of their own, independent of the capitalist?
Yeah.
Yeah. Neil?
I was going to say it's part and parcel with competition. It can go away if you don't have your own.
Yeah, you don't. No capitalists. No capitalist control is competition. You know, you may think they're evil people, capitalists. I mean, I'm sure there are lots of you here. There's nothing, they're not evil. They're all like, not you and me. They're just in a different set of relations. And those relations are independent of their will. You know, those bankers didn't want this crisis. They got into a set of relations that were independent of their will. They themselves had generated a whole system that destroyed them and brought them down. They, poor capitalists, are victim to the very relations which they reproduce. They cannot but enter into new sets of relations with new machines. They have to do it. Competition drives it. There's nothing about capitalism that makes them evil. They, poor capitalists. In fact, capitalists are more pathetic and poor sometimes than workers because they are panicked all the time about what? Competition and whether they'll ever make a profit. They are obsessed with this anxiety, poor capitalists. We should take pity on them. Of all the people in the world, the capitalists will most benefit from what? Communism. They don't understand that, of course. Now look, this is very serious. The point is that both capitalists and workers enter into relations that are indispensable. You can't be a capitalist without entering into relations of exploitation and competition. And both of them enter into this system which they don't control. Which they don't control. Which is actually sowing the seeds of its own destruction, according to Marx and Engels. Sowing the seeds of its own destruction independently of the will of individual capitalists. Capitalists are just carriers of social relations. They just do what the place they hold and the capitalists forces them to do. They do not control the system. This is the Marx and Engels analysis. So you might say serfs. Do serfs enter into relations that are independent and indispensable independent of their will? They too do also. And, well, you could also say possibly that about lords too. Particularly in relationship to GSIs. I have no control over the way I treat these poor serfs. Yes, okay. This is the first point. I know it took a long time, but it's a very crucial point. Marx and Engels have this idea of social relations that exist, in a sense, independently of the individuals that carry those social relations. Those social relations have a logic of their own. We have to enter them, and then, of course, we set them in motion in a way that we do not control. Lilia, you had your hand up.
And I was going to say, aren't the capitalists indispensable because they also workers to buy their products in order to survive.
Right. Capitalists enter into relations that are both or they enter into relations of competition and exploitation, and they're also, in a sense, those relations are independent of their will. In a sense, they generate, those relations generate crises of overproduction, which puts, of course, capitalists out of business. They don't control that. Yeah. Okay, very good. That was point number one. Woo! Don't panic, don't panic. Let me panic. Right, point number two. Point number two. Point number two. You'll see the significance of the second sentence in point number one later. But I will return to that. Page 3 to 5, isn't it? Where am I? Okay. Okay, right. I want to move down to the sum. Sienna. Page 4.
The sum total of these relations of production constitutes the economic structure of society.
That is, the forces of production and the relations of production together constitute the economic structure of society. Uh-huh.
The real foundation on which lies the legal and political superstructure and to which correspond definite forms of social consciousness.
Right. Right. So here's the picture then. Okay, let's do this. Okay, yeah, continue reading. Yeah, very good.
The mode of production of material life conditions social, political, and intellectual life process in general. It is not the consciousness of man that determines their being, but on the contrary, their social being that determines their consciousness.
Okay, fine. Let's draw a picture. Here is what? This is what we call the base. Whoops, the base. That's called the economic structure. Okay, and it includes what? The forces of production and the what? Relations of production. That's the economic base, the base. On this, we build the... What do we build on top of this? This is the foundation for... Superstructure, the legal and political superstructure. And this legal and political superstructure, in a sense, is the roof which supports, protects the base. That's, again, the sophisticated Marx and Engels. They realize that the state, in a sense, protects capitalism, protects the economic base. This is the roof. The roof. Okay, but we have another part of this. Point number two is that the real foundation on which rises legal and political supremacy, and to which correspond, definite forms of social consciousness. Here's social consciousness. That's the way we think about the world. Consciousness. Yes. Yes. So, there's a very interesting question is, what on earth is the which referred to here? On which rises a legal and political superstructure, and to which? Well, I think there is a correspondence here. Correspondence. Consciousness corresponds to... So the consciousness of workers, wage laborers, corresponds to their position in the economic structure. So to continue... the mode of production of material life, that's down in the base, conditions now the social, political, intellectual life processes. Now we talk about conditions consciousness. And then finally, it is not the consciousness of men that determines their being, their economic being, but on the contrary, their social being, their economic being, that determines their consciousness. And now we have determines. Interesting set of words. He's saying there's some link here between the economic base, capitalist mode of production, if you will, and that to that base corresponds a certain social consciousness, conditions a social consciousness, and determines, that's very strong, determines a social consciousness. Very interesting. Very interesting. Very interesting. Yeah. Yeah. So, first and foremost, Marx and Engels are saying that the way people think is very much conditioned by their place in the economic structure. The way workers think in terms of, you know, themselves as fragmented individuals, but those fragmented individuals competing in the marketplace can also develop into a... class. A class. Yes. But that's all shaped, it's all shaped by the economic base. Very good. Very good. Very good. Very good. Well, we'll come back to that picture. Okay. That's one picture. There are two fundamental pictures in these two pages. And I'm going to move on now to point number three. Any questions? Did I hear somebody moan, groan? No? Point number three. Okay. Ariana, do you want to read point number three? Oh, your book's hidden away. Point number three. I guess it's pretty difficult to read the book and take notes. Interesting problem, yes. Okay, 2, 4, 6 lines from the bottom on page 4. At a certain stage of their development...
The material productive force,
otherwise known as the forces of production, otherwise known as the capacity to transform nature,
of society come in conflict with the existing relations of production, or what is but a legal expression for the same thing, with property relations within which they have been at work hitherto.
That is to say, property relations,
From forms of development of the forces of production, these relations of production turn into
the fetters of the forces of production. In the beginning, they do what? They push the forces of production forward. And then they fetter, constrain those relations of production. Yes, very good. Thank you, Ariana. Thank you very much. Yes, we'll stop there. Now, can you tell me what Marx is saying for capitalism? Just in your own words. In the beginning, the forces of production develop under the influence of the relations of production, and then the relations of production fetter the forces of production. All right, Maryam. What do you think? Tell me. We're going to do this together, okay? Okay, you ready? Doing slowly but surely. Look. In the beginning, the relations of production push the forces of production forward. What are the capitalist relations of production?
They want to make profit.
Yes, those are the capitalists, right? They want to make profit. And in order to make profit, what happens?
They exploit workers.
But that, they're also not just in a relationship with workers, they're also in a relationship with
each other.
And it's what sort of relationship is that relationship they have with each other? It's a competitive relationship. And that competition drives capitalists to do what?
Innovate
and introduce what?
Machines.
New machines. They go click, 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 click. Well, before they went click, 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 click. And so what this means is that capitalism is developing the
forces of production.
Brilliant! They're developing the forces of production. Through this competition, the relations of production are developing the forces of production. The relations of production are propelling the forces of production forward. We are able to produce things more productively. And so capitalism goes on its merry way. Expands, the forces of production expanding. We introduce new technologies, better machines. We go from steam power to electricity, to electronic age. Capitalism moving forward. And then what happens?
Crisis
of overproduction. Too much being produced and too little can be consumed because of the polarization that has taken place. And what happens now? Crisis of overproduction. What happens now?
Either communism.
You're going too fast. Crisis of overproduction. When's the crisis? How do you recognize a crisis of overproduction? Lilia. Yeah. How would you recognize you're in a crisis of overproduction in this country? Huh?
Prices when things are going down.
You might say prices, but what'll be more, Lauren?
State comes in. It takes over.
Yeah. You might say before that, yes.
There's an excess of good that can't be consumed.
There's an excess of goods that can't be consumed, and therefore what happens to those producing those goods?
They go under.
They lose. So what we see is the closures of factories. We might see foreclosures in housing, but we see, I think last month, September, was the greatest number of loss of jobs since 1974. We know we're in some sort of crisis when that's happening. So what happens then is that in the beginning, the forces of production go on, then the crisis of production mean that we then start doing what? Shutting down, destroying the forces of production, because we cannot actually put them into motion, because there's nobody going to buy the goods. So in the beginning, it expands the forces of production, and then relations of production. Ferem! You don't need to read Marx and Engels, it's all in your head, it's just purely logical. It is a text that has a will of its own, independent of Marx and Engels. And, of course, is indispensable. Yes, right. Good. So that is what Marx and Engels are really saying. The story is this. In the beginning, the forces of production rise, and then they get fettered. That's the relations of production. And here we have the forces of production expanding and then fettered. Right? Right, Jamie Lou?
Right.
Yes. Can you do that for feudalism? What is it? Chelsea, I'm listening.
Oh, you actually... No.
No! That's very contradictory. What is it about the feudal relations of production that fetters the forces of production? Yes, Christy. What is it about the feudal relations of production? Yes, we did it once very quickly. Yes, Jason?
It's not about commodity exchange, it's just like making your own subsistence.
Yeah, there is continuity, there is tradition, everything is done in the same way. There are these hierarchies, status hierarchies. Everything is done in the same sort of ways. Individual production, very little idea of socialized production. Yes, so basically what Marx and Engels, they don't develop this, could say that the feudal relations of production in the countryside fetter the force of production because they do not gender competition and laws. There's no such competition. Everything stays the same. It cannot compete with the capitalist relations of production, the capitalist forces of production that are expanding. Good. Anyway, so, right. So, yes. Right. What point are we on? We're on three. We've just done three, right? So let me just give you a... So this is basically three. Now, this is the idea of the dynamics of a mode of production. Now, we're going to move on to point four. Who's going to read point number four? Any volunteers? Lilia, your hand is up. Point number four. Yes. Oh, but don't say it like that. I mean, this is the most dramatic moment. Then begins a moment of...
Social revolution.
Very good.
With the change of the economic foundation, the entire immense superstructure is more or less rapidly transformed.
Right. So, the question is this. The forces of production are fettered. And what happens now? Then begins an epoch of revolution, right, Neil?
Yes.
Revolution! Yeah. And with this revolution, the entire economic base is transformed from one mode of production to another. Look, this is the big picture of history. This is the big picture of history. This is Marx. This is the other picture. Two axes. One is history, time. The other is the expansion of the forces of production. This is how it goes. Ancient mode of production. Remember, slaves and citizens. First, the forces of production expand, and then they're fettered, and then what happens? Revolution. And on goes the forces of production. And then they're fettered again. Now, feudalism. Feudal mode of production, feudal relations of production. And what happens now? What? Conrad, what happens now?
Evolution.
Evolution or revolution? Revolution. Oh, we are really tired. That's good. It's good to be tired. Right, revolution, and then only if there's a revolution, then the forces of production continue on their merry way until they are fettered by the... See, what happens with the feudal relations of production are replaced by the capitalist relations of production. And forces of production continue, they begin to grow, and then they are fettered. And then what happens, Conrad? Another revolution. Poor, so many revolutions. Revolution. And then what happens? What happens next? What happens next according to Marx and Engels? The last of Christy.
Well,
that's right. Bob's your uncle. Communism. Tell me, ladies and gentlemen, is communism a mode of production? Why not? No classes, yeah, Neil? Yeah, well, it's a very interesting question. You see, you know, when Marx talks about these social relations into which men and women enter that are indispensable, independent of their will, that's a critical comment. We don't control those social relations. Under communism, we will control the social relations into which we enter. There will be not this disjuncture between the individual and the social relations into which they enter. Marx and Engels never talk about a communist mode of production. They talk about communism. Modes of production have a critical moment because they imply the oppression of individuals, the forced specialization of individuals. Whereas, of course, under communism, we live in the realm of freedom. Very good. Very good. Very good. So this is it. This is the story. Revolution, revolution, revolution. Fascinating story. I mean, it is really problematic. I mean, it's really problematic. You know, does anybody know what the difference between this revolution and that revolution is? Who makes this revolution here? From feudalism to capitalism? The bourgeoisie. Are they the oppressed class under feudalism? No. They're an emergent class alongside the lords. Who's the oppressed class under feudalism? First, are they revolutionary? Well, they engage in rebellions, but they're not revolutionary. What happens under capitalism? Capitalism, whose days is the revolution? The proletariat. This is the first time in history, you might say, the revolution is made by the subordinate class. And the subordinate class is the overwhelming majority of society. And because it is the overwhelming majority of society, and because it contains the mission of all previous subordinate classes, it will be also the abolition of all classes, Marx and Engels say. But we see that these revolutions are not exactly identical. Very good, very good, very good. Very good. Any questions about this? This is a simple, he says obviously more things later on, but this is the basis. These are the two, this is a static picture in which a base is protected by the superstructure, and the base gives rise to social consciousness, and this is the succession of modes of production. History is a succession of modes of production. History is the succession of modes of production. History is a history of class struggle, and history is the dynamics of each individual mode of production. Yeah. Okay, Tracy. Yeah? Okay, very good. Now we get to the fun part. Whew, I'll read the fun part. Uh-huh. Third line from the top on page 5. Now concentrate. I know it's tough. It's hot. It's the middle of the semester. Midterms are due. It's 4:35 in the afternoon. You've only got 25 more minutes to last. You can do it. Okay. Now, third line from the top. In considering such transformations, a distinction should always be made between the material transformation of the economic conditions of production, which can be determined with the precision of a natural science, and, on the other hand, the legal, political, religious, aesthetic, philosophic, in short, ideological forms in which men become conscious of this conflict and fight it out. I'll give 5 B's to somebody who interprets that. I've never given 5 B's out in the history of my teaching.
Give us a second to read what you read.
Okay, you can just all sit down and look at it. I'll give you a minute. In fact, I got a better idea. Why don't you just talk to your neighbor about this? See if you can figure it out with your neighbor. And I'll come back in 30 seconds. Yes, your neighbor. Find a neighbor. Come on, figure this one out. Taking a break here. They're working it out in the class. At least I hope they are. Okay. Whew. Tough. Middle of the semester. Very tough. Okay. Who's volunteering? There's no such thing as the wrong answer. Katie.
Okay, he's pointing out that capitalism, like all the revolutions before, the revolution is based on materialism, is based on controlling the surplus and gaining power, whereas the revolution for communism is going to be an ideological revolution. The proletariat are going to see the ideologies, the idiocy and the ideologies of the capitalists or the bourgeoisie, and realize that it's not good for them, and try and change that and make everything
easy. Uh-huh. So that's... It may be true of previous revolutions, because he's basically talking about He's not saying specifically capitalist here. It's all truth. So it's not just capitalist. But what you're doing is you're putting a lot of emphasis here, which I think is exactly what Marx is doing, a lot of emphasis on the formation of this consciousness.
Yes.
He juxtaposes on the one hand, very good. Very good. He juxtaposes on the one hand, and considering such transformations, well, considering what transformations? Economic transformations. Transformations of the economic base, right? Transformations of the economic base. As opposed to the consciousness. There is a science. What is this idea? On the one hand, that is, something obeys laws of science, and the other obeys the laws of struggle and development of consciousness. What is he saying here? You've got one half of it here, the importance of the consciousness. But what is this contrast between science and... what's this section called? Science and revolution. Between science and revolution. What's going on in this sentence? Yes, Matthew.
How I interpret it is he's making a distinction between theory and praxis.
Uh-huh.
And the difference between how people think about it or how people interpret it and how it actually plays out. You could say, oh, this happened because I saw it happen, but as far as interpreting events through theory, it's a bit different.
Maybe. Maybe. When he talks about science here, what is he referring to? What is he referring to when he talks about science? Jane?
Empirical, evidence-based knowledge.
Yes, it is. Let's see. But he talks about science. When he thinks of science, he thinks of laws. He thinks of, like, the laws of the planetary system. You know, look, let's read this. It's very tricky, but it's brilliant. It's considering such transformations, those are these economic transformations of the economic base, down here. In considering such transformations of the economic conditions of production, in considering such transformations, a distinction should always be made between the material transformation of the economic conditions of production, the base, which can be determined with the precision of a natural science. This transformation can be determined with the precision of a natural science. What is he talking about here? Absolutely, Rosa. The laws of capitalism. And what are the laws of capitalism?
Competition
leads to, first of all, the development of forced production and then the fettering. Brilliant. It's this picture. Communism, capitalism, crises of overproduction, class struggle. Everything's a C here. This is basically like the planetary system. It's a system of laws. It's inevitable. It's inherent. It can be determined as if it were a science. Basically, Engels looks at the capitalist system and discovers its laws, the inevitable development of crises of overproduction and class struggle leading to communism. It's science. We can determine the transformation of the economic struggle with a science. This is science. We can understand this as scientifically. But he says, can be determined with precision of natural science, and the legal political residues, they said again, short philosophy, in short, ideological forms in which men become conscious of this company and fight it out. A distinction should be made between the science here, scientific laws, and the what? The ideological forms in which, this is where you were right, Katie, the ideological forms in which men and women fight out their interests. What is Marx saying here? He's saying, in fact, that this legal, political, and if you want, ideological superstructures are shaping social consciousness as well as down here. I wish I had colored short, but anyway, this is the new arrow here. He's saying that the forms of state shape the forms of consciousness and therefore the forms of struggle. In this country, we do a lot of struggling around what? The working class struggles around what? Well, defends its immediate economic interests. But a lot of the struggle takes place on the terrain of what? The law. And what does the law do? It constitutes people as what? As individuals with equal rights before the law. The law doesn't constitute, for the most part, people as classes, but as individuals. The market constitutes people as individuals, competing individuals. And the political structure, where we do have political parties, but with all this talk about individual voters who contribute to the elections. So it's the idea of the legal, political, and ideological, and we live in a world of what? American individualism. So in this case, it's individualism. The sanctity of private property. Private property, sanctity of. What else is part of the American ideology that comes pouring down from above?
Freedom.
Freedom. Individual freedom. Uh-huh. Yeah. Very good. See, what Marx is saying here is you can determine the rise and fall of capitalism with the precision of a natural science, but the class struggle cannot be determined with the precision of a natural science. That is shaped by these superstructures. So what is being said here is what? The class struggle is not what? BB, what a relief. Not inevitable. The class struggle, or the intensification of class struggle, is not inevitable. On the one hand, there is the emergence class struggle from below, as in the Communist Manifesto. But now Marx is saying that from above, there is another force, an individualizing force, and we do not know which is going to win out. We do not know whether, in fact, class struggle is going to be intensified, if it's going to continue to increase, as Marx is now saying in page 4, 5. Yeah. What does this mean? It means that here we have the fettering, but what can happen here? Barbarism. The point is, this is inevitable, the rise and fall. That can be determined with the precision of a natural science. But this class struggle, it seems to be, reading this carefully, is shaped, is not, you cannot determine this with a precision of natural science. This is shaped by a conflict of these two tensions, the individualizing ideology from above, in the case of the United States, and the class formation coming from below. And we don't know which is going to win out. It is not inevitable that we are going to move on to communism. As I read this page 5. Chelsea.
It also kind of seems like what he's doing here is normalizing the fact that if this revolution were to take place, it would have to be by force. Because when he goes on next to be like, well, you know, you wouldn't judge a man by the things he says he is, you know, like, you can't really judge the consciousness of the time, like, what people think is going on and what they think they want isn't necessarily true. This is inevitable, so we get to choose if we go with it or not, and that almost seems like he's being like, okay, so these relations, they're independent of our will, capitalists might not like this, but if you accept that this is natural, this, you know, move from capitalism to communism, then I've absolved myself of the, like, there being any problem with taking them down forcefully, because they don't know what's right for them, their consciousness is...
Right, no, I think, no, absolutely, absolutely. I think that Marx and Engels would be happy to repress the capitalists in order to get to communism. The question is, will the working class organize itself to be an effective force in that repressive process? Now that is being questioned, you see. And right, now we understand why Marx and Engels wrote the 20, 30, 40, 50 tomes that they did. If it was all inevitable, why would they bother to write anything? They write because this revolution is not inevitable. And of course, the revolution is going to depend on consciousness. Do you notice a contradiction here between the Marx of page 5 and any other Marx we've read? I heard a yes. A yes at the back, perhaps. Oh, come on, come on. Juliana, what's happened to you today? Do you remember where you began? What's the first thing we read, serious text we read of Marx and Engels? Long text, Neil.
German ideology.
And what is the German ideology all about?
German ideology is him criticizing Hegel for thinking that changing ideas and consciousness is next to God.
Right, basically, that's absolutely right. Brilliant. The German ideology is all about the fact that consciousness is this epiphenomenon, this effect of material change. But now we see a more sophisticated version that in fact it's not, this consciousness is not somehow springing naturally, inevitably from below, but in fact is a terrain of struggle. And so consciousness creeps back into their analysis, which was why you were exactly right, Katie, to emphasize that when you began your interpretation. Yes, Neil?
Does he write more and more as he realizes that he's wrong and more and more?
I'm just
wondering, it's just within the same book. I mean, he's like, he writes more and more as he realizes that he's more and more wrong as he like goes through.
Yeah, well, you know, people develop. You're going to develop, we're going to develop, these theories are going to develop, they're going to be wrong, we're going to write them, we're going to make them wrong, we're going to write them. That's how theory develops. And Marx himself. And that's what the big debate, the great theorists are the ones that contain all these contradictions in them that we can wrestle with every year since they die. You know? So you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, I don't think he's fully conscious of this contradiction. But you know, it's very interesting. The German ideology was never meant to be published. This was his settling accounts with the Hegelian tradition. It was never meant to be really published. It was an extreme reaction to. And now we get a more modified, sophisticated version in which consciousness is not predetermined, not given by the economic conditions. We must move on because I've only got 8 more minutes, and I have got 2 more theses to go through. Very good. We are really making good progress here. The next thesis is thesis number 6. And I will start with no social order. You're there, Marianne. No social order. 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14. About 14 lines down, 15 lines down. On page 5. Huh?
Okay. No social order ever perishes before all the productive forces for which there is room in it have developed. No social order ever perishes before all the productive forces for which there is room in it have developed. And new higher relations of production never appear before the material conditions of their existence have matured in the womb of the old society itself.
Finish. Good. Excellent. What is being said here? What is being said here? What is being said here on the first? Let me repeat it to you. No social order ever perishes before all the productive forces for which there is room in it have developed. So you can't have a revolution before what? Before you know that the... Yes, Kristen?
That the conditions are right and in place for the next order of being.
Right, and the next order of being, the next mode of production have to be in place. There have to be already rudimentary forms of the next mode of production, and the existing form of production must be completely unable to develop the forces of production anymore.
Which we're on the verge of almost seeing.
Well, we may be. Marx thought so at the time. And Lenin thought so at the time. And now I'm sure there'll be Marxists that come along and say it's true now. It's a very interesting phenomenon. But let's come back to that in a second. What is being said is that if you are here, what must you not do? If you are here, what must you not do? Neil?
Try to go to
communism, because this is a premature revolution. You have got to make sure that the forces of production are fully fettered and cannot develop. And so often history, we think we're in a crisis, we think the forces of production are now fully fettered, and in fact, it turns out that the crisis becomes a foundation for new forces of production. Marx and Engels can never be wrong. They can always say, ah ha ha ha, the forces of production could still develop. Yes. Yes, so Marx and Engels say premature revolutions are dangerous. We have to be sure we're here. We have to be sure we're here. We have to be sure that there is no potential for further development of the forces of production under capitalism. We have to be sure that capitalism has exhausted its potential. And yet we can never be really sure. Juliana.
Is he saying that we could get there, but that still doesn't mean that...
Right. We can... Let's say 2 things. First of all, we cannot start a revolution from here. And even if we are fully fettered, we cannot go there. We might come down here. Absolutely. Very tricky. Very tricky. You can see how more nuanced the whole thing is getting, how more complicated. Good. So basically, before we can move to a new mode of production, the new mode of production has already to begin to develop within the old. So Marx and Engels saw the development of a whole new system of planning amongst capitalists. Banks, joint stock companies, trusts. They thought that was the new socialism. They were wrong. It was a new form of organized capitalism. And we can be wrong again. We can be wrong again, but Marx is always right. Because he can always say, the revolution is not right. Not ready. Capitalism can still develop. Yes, Simeon.
I see another contradiction in that, first of all, the revolution has to be international, right? And then the forces of production have to be developed to the fullest extent. How do you reconcile these? Because, I mean, when you see in a lesser developed country, a situation where they're supposed to be progressing towards a more developed country, as Marx and Engels saw it, at least at one point. That just goes to say right there that they aren't as progressive as they are.
Right. Well, what Marx and Engels, I think, would say, if I'm going to interpret what they say, I think this whole problem, the link between nation and global transformation, is a very tricky one that Marx and Engels don't develop. But they would say, I think, that a revolution in one country can trigger other revolutions, and it could be, as the Bolsheviks thought, that if a revolution happened in the country where the most advanced productive forces are and they were really being fettered, which is what Lenin and Bukharin and Trotsky thought was happening in Germany, then those advanced forces of revolution could be deployed to give a whole thrust forward for the force of production in Russia, for example. Yeah, but it's absolutely right. I mean, I think there is the presumption that somehow the world becomes evenly and totally developed, and that the crisis is of a global crisis. But our crises are indeed becoming more and more global. And there is a sense in which the forces of production are spreading themselves, I believe, around the world. At the same time, generating a lot of uneven poverty. But indeed, it is the case that productive forces of the most advanced kind are indeed going across the world increasingly, I would say. Ah, yes, but we have still one last hypothesis here. Yeah. And I got 3 minutes. Ah, timed it beautifully. And let's go to number seven. Okay, Simeon, why don't you read it out? The bourgeois relations of production. 2, 4, 6, 7 lines from the bottom of that paragraph.
The bourgeois relations of production are the last antagonistic form of the social process of production. Antagonistic not in the sense of individual antagonism, but one of arising from the social conditions of life of the individual. Same time, the productive forces developing the womb of the bourgeois society create the material conditions for the solution of that antagonism.
That antagonism between the forces and relations of production, that antagonism between classes, right? Go on.
So, the social formation brings, therefore, the prehistory of human society to a close.
This social formation. What social formation? The new social formation, which is called communism. So communism brings the prehistory of mankind. Is it mankind? Womankind. Mankind. Human society. The prehistory of human society to a close. What is being said in this thesis number 7? What is being said in this thesis number 7? Yes, Sienna.
Doesn't he assume that history is based in the conflict of all most production? So with communism, there's no more conflict of most production. So
no more conflict between forces and relations of production.
Right.
Yeah, and therefore.
Therefore, there's no more prehistory. But then what happens?
Yeah. Then if there's no prehistory, then there's what?
History.
Aha! Now what is history? If all we've been living in is prehistory, now what is history? Ha 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 ha! Yes, Neil.
Doesn't say that history is the study of class struggle.
You got to be tricky with Marx. Marx uses these words differently in different places. Indeed, he says, history is history of class struggle. Indeed, he does. But he should have said, prehistory is the history of class struggle. No. You got to get the nuances. He's playing with words. He's a brilliant guy. Don't put him down. What is he getting at when he says that communism brings the prehistory of human society to an end? Chelsea?
Are
I think this is when Engels talks about in socialism, right? This idea that we finally learn how to harness these social forces and not let them be out of our control and out of our will. And in that specifically, we, as a species, stop overcome our need to need subsistence. I know we talked about
We're still needing subsistence. Well, I don't think that will continue, but you're absolutely right. This true history that begins with communism is a history that we make ourselves collectively. So far, history is made behind our backs. We enter into relations that are indispensable, independent of our will. Those relations have an autonomy, have a life of their own. They expel capitalists here, they expel workers there, drawn back in here, create crisis tomorrow, overproduction today, overconsumption tomorrow, it generates polarization. This is a world that we do not make. It's made behind our backs. We are agents in this process, but we are not consciously controlling history. The whole point of true history is that we collectively make it. Prehistory is what we've had so far. Prehistory. History behind our backs. Prehistory. History behind our backs. Behind our backs. History we don't control. Relations we don't control. But now we're into true history. That is to say, we make history collectively. We make history. We transform the world according to our collective plans, collective conjectures. All right, this sounds romantic and utopian nonsense. But you've got to get at the idea, the profound idea that Marx and Engels are giving us here. Namely, that we are living in a world today here, and hitherto all time, since time immemorial, a world in which basically we don't control the lives. Look at you. You're like machines. At 5 o'clock, you start putting your jackets on. You start getting restless. You don't control history. You wouldn't dream of staying over 5, would you? You don't control your destiny. You're being controlled by capitalist time and exhaustion. You have a good weekend. Bye. Those are the 7 theses.